tonight, Venerable Chodron, is in Dharamsala. She's giving a talk on the foundation of Buddhist practice at Tushita Meditation Center. And so we'll continue with our review of collected topics or the course in Buddhist Reasoning and Abate, what Venerable has already covered. So let's start with our motivation. Today I was remembering a story that Venerable Chodron told in the book she co-authored with Russell Coltz called An Open-Hearted Life. It was a story about His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Many years ago, there was an American journalist who was interviewing His Holiness and said to him, Your Holiness, you seem like such a happy person, but you've been a refugee for decades and not able to return to your homeland. There's been genocide, there's been incredible environmental destruction in Tibet, and your people have suffered tremendously, both those who remained in Tibet and many of those who followed you into exile in India. Why aren't you angry at the illegal occupation of your country and by the communist Chinese? And the Dalai Lama gave her one of his infectious smiles and said, If I was angry, I would be miserable. I wouldn't be able to sleep or eat properly, and my health would suffer. And that would be of no use to anyone. So I look at all that is good and rejoice in it and keep my mind happy. Wow, that's a loaded statement. I look at all that is good, rejoice in it, and keep my mind happy. The Buddha said that we're the creator of our own happiness and suffering. Actually, our mind is the creator of our own happiness and suffering. Our mind is the creator of our own samsara and nirvana. And so if we look to the Dalai Lama's example, here's someone who has 100% conviction in the law of cause and effect. And so we can check our own minds to see how strong is our own conviction in the law of cause and effect, the first general characteristic that karma is definite, or actions are definite. I'm just checking. You know, the habitual tendency is very strong to succumb to the afflictions, especially when things don't go our way or we experience physical or mental suffering. So just to check in those moments, how strong is the habitual tendency to err towards the afflictions, and how strong is our new budding tendency to steer our mind in a positive direction so that we can continue progressing, creating the causes, following the graduated steps on the path to enlightenment, so that we can ultimately be of greatest benefit to all beings. The study of logic and reasoning is really a brilliant method for developing greater confidence and wisdom regarding the internal law of cause and effect, as well as dependent arising in many other things. So tonight, let's continue in our studies, and not just for our own greater sense of happiness and well-being, but so that we can continue to increase our good qualities, our wisdom, our compassion, our ability to help others, so that we can lead them to a lasting state of happiness as well as ourselves. We have a number of people with us tonight who probably haven't been following along the Thursday night teachings. And so tonight might sound like Greek to you. but just as a little introduction, we're learning how to, we're learning the language of debate. And so we're beginners at this, but we're learning the language. We're learning how to go step by step, and we're relying on an ontological presentation of how things exist. It's a basis. You know, we talk about the basis, path, and result in the Buddhist tradition, and the basis really is describing what exists, how does it exist, at least on a conventional level specifically, but also ultimately. And so in what's called collected topics. That's the first topic that they study in the monasteries. There's a presentation of how things exist. And so we've been going through this description, this outline. The largest category is the selfless. Everything lacks a self. And this is a particular it's a presentation from a particular point of view. There are different tenet systems within Buddhism. Have you heard talking about different tenet systems? Like there's the Great Exposition School and the Sutra School, the Mind-Only School, and the Middle Way Schools. And, you know, typically we follow the Middle Way Consequence School. But here in this study, we begin by looking at the Sutra School, and particularly the Sutra School following reasoning. And there's a very important reason why the monastics or the people interested in this study begin there. And it's because the way they describe reality accords with how we experience things. So, for instance, they do propound a selflessness of person, you know, that the person lacks a particular way of being, but they assert that external phenomena, exist the way they appear. And things appear to be truly existent, don't they? As if they just exist independently from their own side. We have to check and see if that's the case. And so this school is like a very easy or gentle introduction to learning a particular worldview, a Buddhist worldview, one that does refute self a person, grasping at the self to exist in a reified way of sorts. But it also helps us to accept where we are in how things appear to us and beginning to slowly question them. And we're doing this by looking at, you know, a very clear outline. The selfless is the largest category and is divided into things that exist, existence and non-existence. And so of existence, then we can divide that further. There are things that exist that are impermanent, and there are existence that are permanent. Like emptiness is permanent. It's not changing moment to moment. And so there are lots of different terms that we're learning. It's like learning a new language. You know, you have to learn the vocabulary. And so we're on page 181, I think. I think that's where we are tonight. So we're about just almost halfway through the book. So understandable if you don't totally understand everything that we talk about tonight. But you might find some of this of interest, and maybe you'll be interested enough to follow along on Thursday nights. Or not. It's your choice. But one of the skillful ways that Venerable has begun each of the sessions is by asking us to identify some of our crazy thinking. You see, the thing is, we believe most of what we think, and we never question it. We just think, well, I think it, therefore it's true. It must be true. What I think is true because I think it. That's an invalid syllogism, isn't it? So there are particular ways that we have learned to check what we call a syllogism. And a syllogism consists of three parts. There's a subject, there's a predicate, and then there's a reason. And so we come up with a subject, whatever it is, the subject, blah, is or exists in a certain way because. And we use this line of logic all the time, don't we? I'm going to do this because da-da-da, right? But do we ever stop to say, well, is that a correct syllogism? Is that a correct reason? Does it match up? So the way we test this, a correct syllogism, is we look to see, is the reason a quality of the subject? And not just a quality of the subject part of the time, but is it a quality of the subject all the time? So we have to look at the relationship between the reason and the subject. That's the first thing we do. And then we look to see, is there pervasion between the reason and the predicate? And if those things match up, then we can prove our thesis, which is the subject and the predicate. Those are a bunch of words. Did any of them land? Okay, so an example is sound is impermanent. Because it's a product. Sound is impermanent, meaning sound has the quality of subtle impermanence, something that we can't see with our senses, because it's a product of causes and conditions. So we can know with our senses, we can see, when I do that, a sound is produced. So that's a product. The sound of the gong is a product. But the fact that that sound is disintegrating moment by moment, I can only understand through inference. You know, I can't see that. I can't hear that. It's too subtle. So I'm trying to prove that sound, the subject, sound, is impermanent. And I'm using something more coarse than impermanence, subtle impermanence, to prove that, because it's a product. So I look to see, well, is sound a product? Is a product of causes and conditions? Sound is a product of causes and conditions, isn't it? Causes and conditions come together, like the sound of my voice is a product of vocal cords and wind and my tongue and the palate and all the rest. So it's a product. But how would I prove that the sound of my voice is changing in every subtle moment? So then I look to see, okay, so sound is a product. Product is a quality of sound. But is everything that is a product necessarily subtly impermanent? It is, isn't it? How could you get a big change if you didn't have moment-by-moment changes? We can see that in a gross level, and so we can understand that even at, I think, even at a subtle level, we can understand that. So then, if we have those two pieces together, then we can begin to come to a conclusion. Sound is impermanent. Okay, so here's a reason that came up in my mind. I hope you have a few. Here's one that I noticed in my mind this week. Anger is appropriate to express when setting a boundary with someone who is expressing anger towards me because it protects me from others' anger. I tried to pull this off. It didn't work. So if I was to check, is the property of the subject, is the reason a quality of the subject, anger protects me from others' anger. It didn't at all. In fact, it made a mess. I had to clean it up. So if that reason is not established, then we don't even go any further. If that reason had made sense, if the reason was a quality of the subject, then we check to see, is there pervasion between the reason and the predicate. So that was my disaster this week. What about yours?
Consider the subject of Chinchini. She can't get a cold because she has many important things to do in the next 7 days and people are counting on her.
Okay, let's check. What's the property of the subject?
The subject is Chinchini. The property of the subject is that she has many important things to do in the next 7 days and people are counting on her.
Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there's some qualitative words in there, but okay, and then check the pervasion.
Anyone who has important things to do in the next 7 days and people are counting on them necessarily cannot get a cold.
There are three people missing tonight because they are not feeling well. Is that true? No pervasion.
I don't know. Do they have important things to do?
I bet if we asked them, they would say yes.
I think they do.
I think everyone in this Abbey has important things to do in the next 7 days.
Yeah.
And people are counting on you. Okay, thank you.
Okay, this has been coming up for me for a while. The subject, Semke's body, has had physical challenges this past year because the subject, Semke's body, has engaged in occupations that required much physical work for 35 years. So the subject, Semke's body, has had physical changes this past year. I think that's true. The subject, Semke's body, was engaged in occupation that required much physical work on and off for 35 years, not all the time. And then the pervasion is whenever a body is engaged in occupations that require much physical work off and on for 35 years are necessarily going to have physical challenges. Not well, maybe.
Can you think of an example of someone who doesn't have, who might fit that description and doesn't have physical challenges?
I would say a yoga instructor is someone who's done a lot of physical things, but aren't necessarily in bad shape.
I can think of a few yoga instructor friends who have had physical difficulties to the point that they couldn't teach their yoga classes. So I think just the fact that we have contaminated aggregates lends us to be subject to challenges and difficulties. Is that what you said? Suffering? Physical challenges. Yeah.
I think as far as having physical challenges, this past year I could do a number of syllogisms saying the subject Semke's body has had physical challenges this past year because the subject Semke's body is the result of composed of contaminated aggregates under the influence of polluted karma. I could say the subject Semke's body has physical challenges this past year because the subject Semke's body is a body that by its very nature gets old, sick, and dies. So there's a few of them that I could have, but this is the one that's...
Because the predicate has challenges this year, it's not necessarily true that because of the strenuous labor in the last 35 years, this year will be the year that things ripen.
Well, this is... Okay, so this is maybe a weak spot of this syllogism. What does challenges mean? We all have challenges every day, don't we? Just because we have bodies, aren't we uncomfortable? Like we shift in our chairs because we're uncomfortable? That's a little challenge. We have to eat 3 times a day at least, maybe more, because of our body.
But injuries and, let's put injuries.
Okay, but injuries, if you're saying, so if you add that to the predicate, then that's not necessarily true for every person, is it? That they would have, each year they would have a physical injury requiring medical attention?
No, I wouldn't put medical attention there.
Again, we'd have to define medical attention. Does that mean you take Tums once a year or an aspirin or ibuprofen because you worked a little too hard? I mean, see, this is the thing. We have to be very precise with our language.
So the predicate is because of 30, or the reason is because of 37 years of activity? That's the reason, yeah?
Because she has worked, difficult jobs? Yeah.
That's the reason. Okay. So some people don't have or manifest physical challenges even without 37 years of physical challenges.
That's a good point.
So does that mean that it's not pervaded?
Well, sometimes the pervasion goes both ways. Sometimes there's a mutual pervasion. But typically we're looking to see, does the predicate pervade the reason? We're not looking necessarily to see, does the reason pervade the predicate as well? Like in the case of sound is impermanent because it's a product, that's a mutual pervasion. But take Venerable Simke, she's a woman because she's a nun. That's a pervasion that goes one way.
Some of the difficulties that Venerable Simke's body has experienced don't seem due to hard labor, such as cancer in the eyelid or the lung problem. And so that made me wonder about how the pervasion is weak here, because it could be that somebody could be experiencing problems and they aren't due to that, as he was just mentioning.
Yeah.
And
that's interesting.
And so how does this system hold together about that? Like,
well, it could be an inconclusive reason.
Right, but you say that you would have to say that.
I think we need to write it up.
You would have to say that
analysis, and this is great. This is how we get clear about our thinking.
So the subject Semke's body is experiencing physical injuries this year because the subject Semke's body was engaged in occupations that required much physical work during, let's say. I had on and off for 35 years. It wasn't all the time, but I would have, that's kind of general. Okay. Because the subject Semke's body was engaged in occupations that required physical work, maybe say for the previous 35 years.
Manual labor.
You can also say that. Yeah, that's even more specific.
We're trying to strengthen the relationship between the reason and the predicate. So because actually, the thesis is made up of the subject and the predicate. And so in a valid reason, in a correct reason, we're trying, this predicate, well, actually the subject and the predicate are something that we don't know, something we have a doubt about. in a correct reason, we've already proven to ourselves that the subject has a relationship with the reason, and that whatever is the reason is necessarily the predicate. We already know those things, but there needs to be an active doubt between these two. So, yes, I take your point that we need to strengthen this predicate that is experiencing physical, occupational-related physical injuries this year.
Yeah.
Excessive manual labor.
Well, what's excessive? What's excessive for you may not be excessive for her, or vice versa.
Yeah, but there's people that do manual labor for 35 years that don't have a bunch of work-related injuries, aren't there? But their definition of manual labor might be a lot lighter than yours. I think you worked hard.
This is highlighting how specific we need to be in narrowing down the subject we're talking about, the predicate we're trying to prove, and the reason that we're talking about. So this is why we start off working with very clear definitions, right?
Can we change the reason to something about how we have polluted aggregates?
Well, that was another suggestion that she made.
Yeah, but to make it valid.
So to make it a correct reason, then, okay, let's explore. How could we make this a correct reason? The subject, Venerable Simke's body, is experiencing physical injuries this year in this, what, 62nd, third year? 63rd year, we could say it that way. They don't even have to be work-related, do they?
I was going to say we could pull that out of there if we're going to use polluted aggregates. Yeah. Venerable Sempke's body is a polluted. I mean, they're polluted aggregates because Venerable Sempke's body.
So we haven't tested this yet. So you have a comment, and then we'll go back to.
Just for a matter, not repeating the subject and the reason, like that.
I took out the word the subject. We don't need to say that. Yeah. Because her body. We could even say her body is a polluted aggregate, or because that body is a polluted aggregate. And I wonder about, maybe even staying physical suffering. Injuries implies a certain thing, doesn't it? Like there's been a medical, something that needs medical attention. But what if we just said experiences physical suffering, and it wouldn't matter what year it is. Physical suffering.
Because if you say in a 63rd year, it would be no profession. Because whoever's body is polluted has polluted aggregates, or whoever body is a polluted aggregate, is not necessarily experiencing physical suffering in her 63rd year. Take the subject Tenzin Pella 49.
you don't need that part of the parentheses. Yeah.
It's no privation.
Whoever has a body.
Do you think anyone could go a whole year without any physical suffering?
No way.
I don't think so.
No, but if you would have in a predicate in her 63rd year, then it would not be privated because the reason would not, then it would have to be anybody that is a polluted aggregate would be experiencing suffering in her 63rd year. And that doesn't pervade because... there are people who die when they're 62. You know, it doesn't pervade.
And there are people who die when they're 62.
Or 5.
Uh-huh. So whoever's body is a polluted aggregate necessarily experiences physical suffering in their 63rd year. That assumes a person's alive, don't you think? How can you experience suffering if you're not alive?
But another example would be Arhat. He would not experience suffering anymore, but his body would still be polluted. Aggregate.
From a certain school's point of view.
No.
We are talking about the Sutra school.
Yes. So that's good then, no? That even a Buddha still has a polluted aggregate.
Excuse me? From what school's point of view?
From the Theravada schools.
Okay, so she's got her Sutra hat on. I already switched over to...
Yeah. Because the
if we were to put the subject, Venerable Semke's ordinary body.
Well, this isn't the problem. It's over in the reason.
The subject is fine. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, actually, because it says Venerable Semke's body is a polluted aggregate, I think we'd have to use that in the pervasion. So whatever is Venerable Semke's body, being a polluted aggregate, is necessarily experience physical suffering whether or not it's in her 63rd year or not. Yeah, because that's part of the reason. I think we'd have to stick with that. Isn't that amazing? One thought that went through her head. Well, you said it went through a few times, but and we've done a pretty good analysis of it. So there's another way of thinking about it, isn't there?
Well, this was another way of thinking. This is the one that was the most. This was the one that was the most weak.
Okay,
that's
good.
Why I put
it. Good, good. Thank you. Yeah, here. Remember that we're trying to pull out the crazy thinking, just so that we can see it more clearly, and just so that we can see the purpose of how we can apply logic and reasoning to our own thinking.
The thing I think this illustrates, it's really great because it shows how even you're on the mark and then you slither off with a little bit more elaboration about, oh, it's because I was injured or because I did all this work, and you want to blame something else. So it's nice. It just shows how slippery our reasoning is if it's not analyzed so carefully.
Yeah. Amazing if we spent this amount of time of analysis for all of our thoughts.
Oh, my God.
We couldn't do anything else, but boy, we'd have clear minds. Okay. Anyone else? All right. So maybe we should go on. I want to just finish up a couple of things that we talked about last week. I had some nice correspondence with Venerable Dunyu at Sarah J. Monastery this last week, and I asked him some of the questions that I was left with after last week's class or review. And so I asked him about articulate sound. We had quite a bit of doubt about what exactly is articulate sound. When we talk about sound, the different types of sound include pleasant and unpleasant sounds, articulate and inarticulate sounds, and sounds that are caused by elements conjoined with consciousness and not conjoined with consciousness. So articulate in general indicates meaning. It indicates meaning, and so the question came up, well, does a dog's bark indicate meaning necessarily, or what about the song of the sound of a gong that we ring before class? That indicates a meaning, like, hey, you better get to class. You have 5 minutes or 10 minutes. So what about those things? And it was left kind of unclear. So I asked him about that. He said, regarding articulate sound, it's up to the debater to analyze and figure out what this category is getting at. As mentioned in the review, articulate sound is one of the three classes of object possessors or subjects in the mind and awareness topic. So it seems like it's probably important. We should check into it. We should think about it a lot, debate it with each other, come to some conclusions. The more deeply we're able to get into pramana or valid cognition, debate and understand it, the more deeply we're able to get into pramana and read a variety of scholars' views and explanations, then we'll have more ammunition to use in debate and understanding it. It starts to make more sense when you bring in the explanation of conceptual minds and look at the way that a speaker's words project a certain mental image to the conceptual mind of the listener. So, he didn't come down on the point of saying, no, it can't include animals, but he's steering the understanding, the conversation, to think that, or to connect it up with consciousness and how our speech as human beings, after all, the definition of a human is that which is of the type that understands speech and that speaks and understands meaning. So we've talked a lot in this class, and it comes up a little bit later in the text too, about the difference between perceptual consciousness, like when we use our eye consciousness to see, our ear consciousness to hear, we see things directly. But when we think about things, and we've used this example, so if we look at the striker of the gong, we can really study all the fine detail and the shape and the color and the size. Yeah, that's the shape. But if we close our eyes and then think about the striker, notice the difference in the appearance of that image. We get a very general kind of image in our mind that's different. It's not as clear. It doesn't have as much characteristic. It doesn't have as many clear attributes as when we're looking at it with our eyes, our eye consciousness, right? So in this school, the Sutra School Following Reasoning, they make a very big distinction between conceptual consciousnesses. They call them all mistaken because they are mistaken with regard to a generic image or a conceptual appearance to the mind. When you have a conceptual thought, you have a thought about something, a memory about something, you're planning something, there's an image of that thing that appears to the mind as if it is mixed with the thing. You know, if I say, think of your mother, or think of your car, think of your bed, something that exists, it doesn't it seem as if, well, that is my car or my bed or my phone or whatever, especially if you're attached to something, it becomes a little more vivid. But that object could have changed. Or if we think about ice cream, this example came up. If you think about ice cream, probably, what kind of ice cream do you think of? Do you think of some generic ice cream, or do you think of a specific flavor of ice cream? Is it partly melted? Can you feel the coldness of it? You know, there's so much about that object that we don't have access to when we're calling it to mind. Or when we're thinking about someone we might label an enemy, they appear to us in a certain way, and we don't even see any of their good qualities, even though they necessarily have some good qualities, right? We're all a combination of positive and negative qualities. But what appears to us is this 100% negative or bad person, right? So these are things, we're trying to understand these distinctions so that we can begin questioning the appearances to our mind as well as our proliferating thinking about that. Okay, so that was one thing. Can animals make articulate sounds? I see two ways to include animal communication in the presentation. Saying that if something is articulate sound, it doesn't necessarily follow that it's a letter, word, or phrase, because those were the divisions of expressive sounds as found in Lohrig. That was one point. Another point is saying that animals express some meaning and the sounds they use to do so are animal sounds corresponding to letters and words. You could make that case, although he said that's a little bit weak. And he said, again, an argument could be made that they don't utter expressive sounds because of this definition of human being one that speaks and understands meaning, or being of the type of one who speaks and understands meaning. He said it would be cool to see what people who research animal communication think about this. So he has such an open mind, he's willing to entertain anything if it comes up in debate. Okay, and then I asked him, well, what about pleasant? Pleasant seems so subjective. You know, like what's pleasant to me may not be pleasant to you, or vice versa. He says, in some ways, in our culture's mindset, everything is subjective. But seriously speaking, some will just say that the only reasonable way to posit pleasant and unpleasant is to do so from the perspective of the defender. So you have a challenger, someone who's asking the questions, and you have a defender, someone who's defending their position. So that's one way. And then if we're honest, we can probably agree on a number of things that are, in general, pleasant and unpleasant for people. So if you posit the sound of nails on a chalkboard, how many people would see that as pleasant? There might be someone in the world. You know, there's probably a support group for people who find nails on a chalkboard pleasant, and they meet together online somewhere. But in general, I think we can agree that that's an unpleasant sound, right? Although now we have whiteboards, and they're not so unpleasant. So it's the classic example of an aggravating sound. So let's just accept that it's an unpleasant sound. Then it seems quite feasible that these days we could rely on some of the rather intricate understandings of what makes sound pleasant or not from the fields of neuroscience, physics. You know, the way harmonies are created, how the frequencies and amplitudes of the sound waves impact the processing in the body and how that impacts experience, etc. So again, he's very amenable to bringing in scientific information. So then I asked him, are these just for learning debate and not meant for rigorous analysis? He said, well, Venerable, learning debate is learning rigorous analysis. Try and figure out what really makes the most sense. Do pleasant odors simply not exist, or pleasant sounds, pleasant odors, pleasant tastes? Do they exist in a general way? Do they exist but only in relation to a particular individual's experience? So it begs more questions, doesn't it? And so these are the kinds of things that would become much more obvious to us if we were out in the court, if we had time to go out in the courtyard and debate for a few hours. He says, basically, the general hope is that everyone can debate as much as possible in the time allowed that you're covering a particular topic, and by the time the class moves on, you have a decent understanding, a decent enough understanding of that topic. I'd say debate it with gusto for a few sessions, but don't make it the meaning of your life to figure out what a pleasant odor is. Thank you, Venerable Dunya.
It's interesting that this issue of pleasant and unpleasant only comes up with regards to sounds or odors. There's no unpleasant taste. There's no unpleasant colors or sensations. So I wonder why that it's so prominent, you know, in those.
That's an interesting question. Give that some thought and come back to us. It's a debate? Okay. Yeah, there are so many ways to divide each of these pies. And why they chose to select the divisions in one way for one sense source and not another, I don't know. It would be a good sociological study. Perhaps it could be a master's thesis. Maybe someone's already done it. We'll have to look. Okay, so tonight, let's continue with our exploration of tangible objects. Actually, we're looking at external objects, and so tonight we're looking at the fifth of the five divisions of tangible, of external object, external matter. Okay, get it clear. We're looking at external matter, and we're looking at, so we already looked at visual forms, sounds, odors, taste, and now tonight we're looking at tangible objects. Now, what we've been doing in these review classes is really just trying to engage in debate so that we get some practice with that, not just reading through the text again, but actually practicing. And so to begin any kind of debate, there are two different ways. We could start from the very beginning of the outline, selfless, divided into the two divisions, existence, non-existence. We could look at their definitions, look at their divisions, look at the synonyms or the equivalents, how those are divided. We could go into all that level of detail. But we can also start the debate in a much quicker manner. Once we have that outline pretty well set in our mind, we can just go pretty much to the topic. We talked about selfless being divided into existence, non-existence. So when you divide existence, how many divisions are there? Well, it's not wrong. So Venerable Chuni said permanent phenomena and impermanent phenomena. That is definitely one way to divide existence. And what's another?
Functioning things and those that are non...
Phenomena that are non-things.
Yeah. Non-things.
Good, thank you. So it follows that functioning thing and phenomena that are non-things are the divisions of existence.
I accept.
Thank you. I'm glad. So when you divide functioning things is referring to impermanent phenomena. When we divide functioning things, how many divisions are there?
Three.
It follows that those three cannot be posited individually. How unreasonable. Why? Oh, it follows that they can be posited individually, the divisions. Okay. Who's positing them? Posit those, please.
It follows that the three divisions of functioning things are form, consciousness, and abstract composites.
You're right that those are the three divisions. I'm just going to tweak a little bit so that we actually learn this language of debate. So I'm the one who says it follows from your what you say. Those are the I say that's a consequence. So I'm the one who says it follows. You would say the subject.
The three divisions.
The subject, matter.
Matter.
Consciousness.
Consciousness and abstract composites are.
That's it. That's all you say. Because we've already established that we're looking for the divisions. So as a defender, that's how you say it. You say, if I ask for the divisions, you say the subject and then the divisions.
Oh, okay.
That's it. It's very simple, actually.
Yeah, I just remember those long sentences we were practicing way back in the beginning. Okay. We would follow, I accept, and then we'd have to.
What I'm trying to do here is just explain or demonstrate how it's spelled out in our debate primer. Mm-hmm. And this is what I've observed, that when I ask you a question, you give me the minimum you can give me. But we typically say the subject, don't we? So the subject, matter, consciousness, and abstract phenomena, composites. And so then I say it follows. From what you said, it follows. You know, the consequence of what you said is that the subject... matter, consciousness, and abstract composites are the divisions of functioning thing. And you say?
I accept.
Good, thank you. Okay, so we're just quickly going into the debate. We've gone from existence to functioning things to their divisions. We're leapfrogging, aren't we? We're leaping. We're not stopping to look at all the detail along the way. And there's a lot of detail along the way, right? This is what we've been learning the last few months. Okay, so matter is divided into external and internal matter. When you divide external matter, there are five divisions, the last of which is tangible object. So I'm just giving you information now, right? So that we can quickly get to our subject. Yeah, when you divide external matter, there are five divisions, the last of which is tangible objects. The definition of tangible objects can't be posited. So it follows that the definition of tangible objects can be posited. Go for it.
Suitable to be a tangible object. Does that work?
It's not our book. Colonel Pende, I saw you studying last night. Please, give us the definition. I was so happy. You made my day. Definition of tangible object can't be... posit that definition of tangible object.
Oh, the definition of a tangible object is an object experienced by a body consciousness.
Okay, so you'd say the subject.
The subject.
And object experience. Yep.
Oh, I just say the subject, the object experienced by a body consciousness.
Okay, so it follows an object. It follows the subject. An object experienced by a body consciousness is the definition of tangible object.
I accept.
All right. So are you starting to hear the repetition of what happens? I ask a question. If they accept, they say, I accept. If they don't accept, they say, why? We only have two answers if we posit a thesis. The definition of such and such can't be posited. Why are you saying that? It's in the book. Why? So you say, why? It's a challenge. Why do you say that? Oh, so it follows that the definition of tangible object can be posited. I accept. We're limiting. This is the language of debate. So you only have those two options. Okay. When you divide tangible objects, how many divisions are there in the book, from the book? Two. Those two can't be posited individually, Venerable Losung.
What?
It follows those two can be posited individually. And you know I'm going to ask you to posit them.
Accept.
Posit them, please.
The subjects, tangible objects that are the elements, and tangible objects arisen from the elements.
So it follows the subject, tangible objects arisen from, tangible objects that are the elements and tangible objects that are arisen from the elements are the divisions of tangible objects.
I accept.
Okay, good. It's a lot to keep in mind, isn't it? This is what sharpens our mind. We're listening. Hopefully we've got some of this information in our mind already. So we start by looking at the book, of course, and then slowly we repeat it back and forth. You know, that we could go back and forth several times just on that one little debate that we just did until it really sticks in your mind. Then you're ready to move on. This is a skillful means for memorizing, and it makes you listen very carefully to what another person is saying. And you have to remember it, too. You can't just listen. You have to remember it, because then you have to repeat it back to them. Okay. So when we divide tangible objects that are elements, how many divisions are there? Four. Anyone for five? Okay, we'll stick with four. These four can't be posited individually. Thank you. Also, it follows these four can be posited individually. I accept. Okay, so posit those. So it follows the subject, earth, water, fire, and wind, are the tangible objects that are the elements.
I accept.
Great, okay. You're debating, you're doing well. There are tangible elements that are elements, and there are tangible objects that are arisen from elements. So earth, water, fire, and wind are the divisions of tangible objects. I'm sorry, thank you. Thank you for correcting me. Keep me honest. It's hard to think and speak at the same time, so you have to correct me. It's humbling. Thank you. Okay. So these four tangible objects that we've just mentioned, earth, water, fire, and wind, they're actually quite interesting from the Sutra School following reasoning point of view. They are the bases and causes for the seven remaining tangible objects which are arisen from the elements. And there's a really nice section in Dan Perdue's book called Debate in Tibetan Buddhism. It says, the four elements serve as the basis for all material phenomena. So not just for tangible objects, but for all material phenomena. Matter, which is not one of the four elements that is arisen from the elements. Yet the elements do not exist in strictly irreducible units. Rather, they can exist as potencies within physical particles, or the atoms which compose all internal and external matter. So this is a particular point of view. It may or may not match up with what we understand from a Western scientific or modern scientific point of view. Each particle or each atom is an aggregate. Okay, we'll have to say particle because that's not true of atoms. Each particle is an aggregate of at least 8 components, according to this school's presentation. Earth, water, fire, and wind, which we just identified. And then visible form, odor, taste, and tangibility arisen from the elements. That's a little bit hard to swallow, isn't it? Knowing what we know about atoms. But what he's saying is that the 5 types of external matter and the 5 types of internal matter that we have yet to look at are all arisen from the elements. So within external matter, we find tangible objects. There are 4 tangible objects that are elements and 7 tangible objects which are arisen from elements, but all matter is arisen from elements. Can you see the distinction there? All matter is arisen from the elements. In other words, it'll come clear in just a minute. Hopefully, if it doesn't, you can put your hand up. So in this system's point of view, they say that material phenomena are constructed of particles, which rather than being only one element alone, are a composite of these 8 potencies, which include the 4 elements. Okay, so there's more to come about this, but for now, let's just hold on to that. Okay, so I bet you can't posit the definition of the earth element. Or we could just say earth, because we're talking about it from a particular context or a particular point of view. So the definition of earth can't be posited. So it follows the definition of earth can be posited. Okay, posit that definition.
The subject, that which is hard and obstructive.
The subject. So it follows that the subject, that which is hard and obstructive, is the definition of earth.
I accept.
Good. So in Buddhist physics, the 4 elements are like principles of material nature. The nature of earth is hard. Its function is obstructive. So hard and obstructive. Its nature is hard. Its function is to obstruct. The earth element manifests as physical stability or physical stability is a sign of the presence of the earth element. So for example, the predominance of the earth element in a stone is shown by its stability. That's one example. And that's obvious, isn't it? The stone is very hard, very stable. I guess it depends on what kind of stone it is. But the ability of water to form drops and its stability in that form also indicates the presence of the earth element, even in a water drop or droplet. Does that make sense? You know, if we put a bead of water here on the table, it kind of stands up and has form, doesn't it? It kind of makes a little round, what would you call that? Shape. Yeah, a dome or a sphere. The fact that water can serve as a support for leaves or boats or for huge swirling piles of trash in the Pacific Ocean the size of France indicates the presence of earth element in water. Wherever there is physical stability, there is the earth element. So greater or lesser stability indicates greater or lesser manifestation or predominance of earth element. The nature of water is wet. Its function is moistening. The water element is manifest as cohesiveness. For example, a wet cloth will pick up a lot more dirt than a dry cloth. So we're not talking about ordinary water here. Ordinary water is not the water element because water has all 8 of those particles, including water. Well, it includes earth, water, fire, wind, and the other 4 to varying degrees. So think about the difference between dry sand and wet sand. You can drive a car on wet sand, can't you? It can become like cement. It can be hard enough to support a car. And that's due to the surface tension of the water increasing the resistance and cohesiveness in the sand. So we can see how every material thing that we can think about has some degree of all 4 of these elements. The nature of fire is hot and its function is burning. So the fire element manifests as heat. Wherever there is heat, there is fire element. That's really different, isn't it? It's different than how we usually think about fire. You know, we think there has to be an open flame, but even incense is a type of fire because there's heat there. And, you know, of course, we can talk about things like heating pads or those heat pads you take when you go skiing. You know, you open up the chemical and creates a heat reaction. When something is cold in this system, it means that the fire element is non-manifest, not non-existent. The fire element is still existent, but it's just not manifest. It's not predominant. So as with the other elements, the fire element exists even when the others are predominant, such as the sparks produced when you rub, when you hit two stones together. Even though the predominance is earth, there's fire there, fire element. The nature of wind is light and its function is moving. The wind element manifests as movement. And any presence of motility indicates the presence of wind element. The ability of living beings to move is due to the presence of wind within them. It brings a different meaning about being windy, doesn't it? Okay. So the rustling of leaves and branches, like today, I was standing out on the porch before class and the wind was moving through the aspen leaves and making a beautiful sound. That indicates the presence of wind. And there's also a subtle internal wind element that manifests as motility of bodily substances, like food. It's involved in digestion, moving food around, blood, lymph, all those things. There's also a subtle internal wind that serves as a mount of consciousness that we find when we get into higher classes of Tantra. Okay, so how do these two compare? This is another exercise that we do. When we ask, how do two things compare? It really challenges us to understand what those two things are. And so when we're asking how two things compare, we're looking for the relationship. So is there something that's both one and two? Is there something that's one but not two? Is there something that's two but not one? And is there something that is neither one or two? And we try to get really close to those things, but not being either of those things. Okay, so how do these two compare? Earth, you know, in this context, earth, and the elemental makeup of wood. Earth element, earth, and the elemental makeup of wood. You say 3P, you say 4P, four possibilities. Okay, so let's check 3P first. So 3P means that one is a subset, right? So is there, what's something that's both? The aspen tree.
State it again.
Okay. I'll write them down because then you can see it. Yes, I agree. So what we're doing here is similar to what we looked at when we looked at the comparison of blue, you know, which is a color. Blue was one, and the color of cloth. This is what I'm trying to find here. And I'll just tell you right away, I don't necessarily know all the right answers, so we can discuss it. But here we're looking at earth, you know, which is one of the tangible objects that is an element. So earth and elemental makeup of wood. What does that mean? Okay. How about if we just say wood? Okay. That's different. So take a moment to check that one out. Now, I'm not sure if this is going to actually fulfill this kind of relationship. So I was looking for something that could be earth, but it's not necessarily, or the earth element. But it's, that's why I said the elemental makeup of wood.
Yeah, the elemental makeup would be different.
Yeah. So let's try that. Okay, what's something that's both?
The earth element in wood.
The earth element in wood. Okay, what is something that is earth element, but not the elemental makeup of wood? The earth element in water. And what is something that is the elemental makeup of wood that is not earth?
Water.
And something that's neither, that's kind of clever?
The fire element in water.
Good. The wind element in flowers. Okay, good. So that's 4P, isn't it? Is that okay?
4P.
There's four possibilities. Yeah?
Draw it and circle.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Two circles.
So it would look like this. You can find something that's both, something that's one but not the other, something that's the other but not the one, and we can find something that's neither. Other relationships are like mutually exclusive, like hot and cold, or impermanent and permanent, you know, sacred.
We also have things that are mutually inclusive, like product and impermanent. And then we also have something that is called free possibilities, when something is a subset, like mice and mammals. Thanks for that great example. All right, let's do another one.
Okay, how do these two compare? Water and liquid. So water element, we're not talking about H2O, we're talking about water element and liquid. Mutually inclusive. Okay, we have a couple of answers going. Let's check it out. What is something that is water in this context and liquid? The water element in a glass of water or the water element in a lake? I think you'd have to write elements because there's water molecules in that lake too. Well, water is a liquid. Water in a, so, yes, right, okay. Water elements. What's something that's wet and moist that's not liquid? A leaf?
What's liquid that's not wet and moist? Lava.
Lava, yeah, or liquid nitrogen.
When it's wet.
Wet and moistening is the function. Okay, so is the water element in a glass of water liquid? Okay, so those who say yes, it is, what is your reason? Why is it liquid?
Whatever is liquid is wet and moist. Moistening. Whatever is liquid is wet and moistening.
Okay, and those of you who say it's not, what is your reason?
Lava is a liquid. Lava is not moist.
Is there a cohesiveness to lava? I think it's moist. Even though it's hot moist, it's
no,
moist.
It's
no?
Lava has water element in it, yes?
Yeah.
And water element is moist. So therefore, lava must have some moistness. Yeah?
Thank you. Okay.
Steam is wet and moist, but not a liquid. It's a gas.
Wait, we haven't gotten to that choice yet. But hold that answer. That's a good one. We're looking at something that's both. Okay, now what is something that is water in this context, water element, and not liquid? Water element in a glass or a lake. It can't just be in a glass. It has to be in a glass of water. Or there has to be a liquid in that. Yeah, there you go. Now what's something that is water in this context and not liquid? The water element in a piece of wood. That is water, but it's not a liquid, right? And I think if you said water, the water element in ice, that would, or whoever said that. Yeah, it would be the water element in the ice. Yeah, but not the ice itself. Okay, and then what is a liquid but not water? Well, we have one already. Lava or milk?
Well, is no, because we said that lava contains the water element.
Right, okay. So is there a liquid that does not contain a water element? Ha-ha. Yes.
It's not that the liquid contains the water element, but is the water element. Isn't that what two but not one would be? Like,
what is something that is liquid that is not or doesn't contain? I think we'd say is not the water element. It's a liquid, but it's not the water element. Yeah, we're really looking at, it's just like color and color and or blue and the color of cloth. I thought that was okay. We thought that lava is a liquid because it's wet. It's moist. We figured out it is moist. Something that is a liquid that's not the water element?
The earth element of milk.
Well, is the earth element itself a liquid? How about if we just say milk? What is something that is a liquid that is not the water element? We could even say water, couldn't we? Because water is not the water element. Okay, and what is something that is neither water in this context or liquid? Try to be clever, Matt. Not just sky flowers. I mean, you can say rock, car, but you see, try to get something that's close to water element and liquid. But it's not either of those things. It's just a way to sharpen the mind. It's a landslide. Interesting.
It's neither.
Ice. H2. Yeah, that was my example.
No, the words, the lettering.
Ice. H2. Ice is not, but it is not the water element. You see, really, you have to be really clear about what we're talking about here. So everything contains the water element, but it doesn't mean that that material, that matter is the water element. Okay.
Ice.
Ice. All right. Are you having fun? Are you squirming a little? Okay, how about these two? How do these two compare? The fire element and the temperature of water. Oh, wait. Okay, I'm not sure that's going to work. Fire element. Yeah, heat. Yeah. The fire element and the temperature of water. These are all similar, so you can probably guess it. It's supposed to be 4P, but let's see. Let's see how it works out. Okay, the two things that we're comparing here is the fire element and, number two, the temperature of water. I'm not sure I get your question yet.
So, because I think we're
switching back and forth?
Switching, yeah.
Okay.
Are we comparing in terms of existence or in terms of, you know, like being? Like, is whatever is fire element, is it also the temperature of water or not? Or whatever, or does it contain? Whatever is fire element, does it contain? Whatever is temperature of water, does
it contain? I think it depends how we word it, and I think it can be either. For instance, the real nature of fire is heat, right? So you can say the hot temperature of fire or the temperature of boiling water. In my mind, that covers both. It's the heat element that's making that water hot. That heat is the nature of that water. So the two come together. They're one entity, as far as I can tell.
It seems like there's definitely fire element in boiling water. Mm-hmm. But temperature of water is a measurement of that boiling water. It's not the boiling water.
So let's find a way to describe the heat of boiling water.
Well, the heat of boiling water.
The hot temperature. It's boiling water, so you know it's a very high temperature. And what makes it boil is the heat element. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I think I get what you're asking. So let's ask, is hot water, we're talking about water here. It's like white horse, right? The white horse is not white. The hot water is not the hot. It's water that has heat. All right, so how are we going to...
The heat is boiling water.
Yeah. This is why I said the hot temperature of boiling water. So I'm not talking about a specific degree like 212. But please bring up a debate if you have a different idea. That if we're talking about boiling water is water, right? Yeah, I think you'd have to describe it like if you said the blue cloth is cloth, but it's the main thing is the cloth, not the blue, right? So blue cloth is an example of the color of cloth, but it's not blue. Oh, wait, is that true? I get confused with it. Yeah.
I was just saying that I agreed with what you said because water can boil at a very cold temperature if it doesn't have the air or some pressure pushing it down.
Uh-huh, good point. So we'd have to somehow talk about the temperature of boiling water at
pressure.
Sea level, thank you. See how exact we're having to be? So we're learning about each of these examples of comparison. Are you satisfied with that? No. This is something that's both, Venerable Simke.
I'm still trying to what are we
doing? Oh, I see. Okay. I see. The temperature of water. Okay, put a question mark after that one. And I would encourage you to continue thinking about this and see what conclusion you come. Yes.
I think if you were comparing, say, apples and food, you couldn't come up with both by saying apple salad that contains apples or like fruit salad that contains apples.
Okay.
Because that fruit salad is not apples, only part of it is. And that's what we're here is that the heat of boiling water shows the fire element. Is it the fire element?
Maybe off to the side.
Maybe it is.
Just off to the side. Let's go back to our example of blue and the color of cloth, and maybe that can just be as a like a template for us. So we were looking at one, blue. Yeah, okay. So now what's something that's both blue and the color of cloth? Typically we say blue cloth, but we can say...
The color of that blue, the cloth on that blue cushion.
Yeah, the color... So we could say blue cloth. That's like a shortcut, isn't it? But really what we're talking about is the blue color of a particular cloth, like Christina's shirt.
Then you need to say color.
Well, but they accept blue cloth. Yeah, it's like a shortcut. Okay, what is something that is blue, but not the color of cloth? The sky is blue? It's a blue color? It's okay, so we're... Well, how about the color of Medicine Buddha? It's blue, but it's not the color of cloth.
The sky?
The color, the blue color of the sky. We're talking about something that's a color. So we're talking about blue, the color blue. Okay. And then something that is the color of cloth that is not blue. Something that is that it has to be a cloth. A red cloth, thank you. And then something that is neither. An apple. Okay, so this is what I was trying to accomplish. And it is difficult to come up with these examples, especially we don't really talk about tangibility. And, of course, we don't have this description of every particle being a combination of eight aspects. So just like blue is a type of...
The hotness of boiling water,
That
would definitely...
The hotness... Well, how's that different from heat, the heat of boiling water? It's the same. So the heat of boiling water is the fire, the burning aspect of that boiling water, right? So that is the fire element, the predominance of fire element in the water.
Okay, so
thank you.
The heat of boiling water is the fact that the fire element is predominant, and therefore the boiling water is... Therefore, the boiling there is the heat of boiling water. But the fact that there is hotness in boiling water, that is the fire element. I guess you could even say that there is hotness in cold water, because there is a fire element present in cold water too. So hotness doesn't necessarily need to build up to what we would experience as heat. Hotness is just...
It could just be heat.
Well, isn't there... They said there was an absence of heat... There was, it's not like an absence or a non-existence, but a non-predominance, a non-manifestation of the fire element. Okay.
You could change number one from fire element to predominance of fire element. And also, it could be heat of water. All water has some level of heat in it.
Yeah. It's
or it would be ice.
But it's the heat of a specific type of water. It's boiling water. It's not cold water.
Matt?
So Matt's asking, do we need to specify that it's manifest fire element? In boiling water, the predominance is, the heat element is, or the fire element is manifest.
It's already come up, but if we're considering a non-manifest fire element, then cold water is a temperature of water and also has the non-manifest form of fire element.
Okay, so if we erase that, what else will we come up with? Is there nothing?
Heat of water.
Anything that has to do with
that's not wrong.
Okay, so anything that has to do, so it doesn't necessarily have to be the heat of boiling water, it could be the heat of water, period. Yeah, okay. The temperature of water, would that work? No, that's
number two. Okay. Can't you just say the fire element of water?
You know, in this case, I think you can, because the fire element is heat. Let's just leave that for now and put a question mark there, and unless you have something specific to, okay. What is something that is the fire element but not the temperature of water? The fire element of wood. Thank you, Venerable Sultram. And what is a temperature of water that is not the fire element? Can we think of anything? Given that you were talking, you know, about the fire element is there in water whether it's hot or cold. It's just a degree of predominance, right?
The water, so the water element... of the temperature of water.
That is that the temperature of water, though?
Well, what is both a fire element and the temperature of water? That is the fire element of water. So if we accept that the fire element of water is the temperature of water, we also have to accept that the water element of water is the temperature of water.
Mm.
You know, and then a water element of water is not a fire element.
Okay, so that's one suggestion. Can we come up with something else that's maybe a little more straightforward?
No. The temperature of water is the fire element of water.
No, don't write it down. So he's saying that the temperature of water is the fire element, whether it's hot or cold. That's what you're saying?
Yes.
And so you're saying there's nothing that is the temperature of water that is not also the fire element. And let's take a vote, because how many agree with that? Yeah, I'm leaning that way. But like I said, these are puzzles that we get to play with. And this is what we're doing when we go to debate. And you might find this crazy making. You want to pull out your hair because you want a right answer. But this is debate. Yeah, this is why we're bald, so we don't pull out our hair. There isn't anything. What's something that's neither? Matt, you have good neithers. What are they? Skyflower?
The water element and fire.
The water element and fire. So it's 3P. Do you have the constitution for one more?
I have a question.
Yeah, please.
So the fire element is in everything, regardless of how hot or cold it feels or is measured.
Mm-hmm.
What about absolute zero? Is that just theoretical and so it's not to be considered?
Well, absolute zero is a concept, isn't it?
It is.
And so it's not matter.
It's an absence of motion.
Yes, so it's a permanent phenomena. It's not a functioning thing. It's not matter. So we're safe. Yeah. Thanks. It's a great question, though. And this is exactly what we're doing. We're looking for exceptions, and we're questioning, and that helps us to become a lot more clear about, well, what is the fire element? Yeah, good. Okay, so he wanted to see what that looked like in a picture. Just draw a large circle in a... So 3P, three possibilities. Since we cannot find, okay, so which pervades which? You've erased them, but okay, fire element, there is no two that is also not a one. So the two is in the center, right? You can find a one that is not a two, that's in the outside circle. So one, the fire element pervades the temperature of fire. Okay, one more, real quick. Okay, how do these two compare? Wind element and that which moves clouds. You say three possibilities. Anybody else? Mutually inclusive?
Yes.
Anything else? That which moves clouds. Okay, so let's check. What is something that is both wind element and that which moves clouds? So keep in mind that the definition of wind is that which is light and moving. So the wind element manifests as movement. Any presence of motility indicates the presence of wind element.
Yeah.
So it's movement, isn't it?
It's movement
itself. Isn't that interesting? So we'd have to include movement or motility or some kind of action in our answer.
Yeah.
The jet stream on a cloudy day. So the jet stream on a cloudy day is... So would we have to say the clouds in the jet stream, the movement of clouds in the jet stream, so that we know that the clouds are being moved? No? Because the jet stream is like just at a certain level, right? It's not the whole atmosphere. So how do we know there are clouds in the jet stream? The jet stream, the movement of the jet stream could even move clouds that are not in the jet stream, right? Because it's moving all the things that are around it as well.
Well, in that case... It wouldn't be the jet stream that's moving the clouds. It would be the clouds moving other clouds.
Wind moving clouds. I like it. Wind moving clouds. Let's keep it simple. Wind element moving clouds. The wind is movement. There's not something that is wind that has those eight elements. Air would have those eight elements, and it is moving. So it's the movement that is the wind element. Yeah. Okay, we've gotten clear about that. Now, what is something that is wind element and does not move, is not that which moves clouds? The wind element in wood. Thank you, Venerable Siltram. That's a very helpful answer tonight. No, thank you. I appreciate you. They are. You're right. You're right. Very good. Okay. And what is something that moves clouds that is not wind element? So Venerable Siltram is saying temperature, like if you have a temperature gradient.
Temperature difference, as in high pressure and low pressure moves clouds around. That's how we get our weather.
That which moves clouds. This is there's a conflict between Western science and this particular presentation.
Don't you have to define what a cloud is made up of to pursue this?
Well, I think we can have an understanding of what a cloud is. We look at clouds, we see clouds. I don't know that we need a formal definition of a cloud. Well, why would that make a difference? Quick, look up clouds. What are clouds? See these things that we take for granted, like, well, you know, a cloud. Can't, you know, look outside, there's a cloud. Like, don't you know what a cloud is? Well, look up, what is a cloud?
So a cloud necessarily has all eight elements.
Yes. There are water droplets in clouds, right? Yeah. So
that's what clouds are, the water vapor.
Water vapor. Wonderful. So she's saying that a cloud is the reflection of light of the vapor of water that makes up the cloud. Did I get that right? Okay. Which necessarily has all eight elements. Okay. So is there anything that which moves clouds and is not the wind element?
I was just going to ask a question that the clouds who also have all the eight elements in them, they move because they have the wind element in them. Do they necessarily need a second cause to move them? Because they already have the potential for movement.
Very nice.
So if I were to answer that, I would say that it's the wind element in the moving clouds.
But even something that is inert has wind element, and it's not necessarily movement, right? Like a stone has.
No, that's wind correct. But element. we are comparing these two. There's no stone in our comparison. We're comparing wind element to that which moves the clouds, and so I'm saying that both something that is both would be the wind element in the moving cloud.
Uh-huh. So there's a predominance of wind element in the moving cloud, not in the cloud, but the moving cloud.
Whether it's the wind element in the clouds or some external force, it's the wind element that causes motion. So it doesn't matter. It's that which moves clouds is the wind element by this system.
Yeah, so there's nothing.
Whether it's rising heat, a breeze, or something within the cloud that's its own nature.
So you're saying there's nothing which is the movement of clouds and the wind element, not the wind element.
Nothing.
Okay, so didn't we find something that was Venerable Soltam gave us the beautiful answer of the wind element in wood. It's not skyflower for now. All right.
Did you want a definition of clouds or not anymore?
If you have one, go ahead.
A cloud is an aerosol consisting of a visible mass of minute liquid droplets, frozen crystals, or other particles suspended in the atmosphere of a planetary body. So when you drive down the road and you make a cloud of dust, that is a cloud.
Wow.
But it's still being moved by the air, the wind element.
Water droplets, though? Isn't it?
Other particles suspended in
particles.
Atmosphere.
Okay, it can be any particle suspended in air. Interesting. Okay. Did you learn anything tonight? All right. I just want to read one more thing that I found very interesting. All matter, the elements and that arisen from the elements, is atomically established. We know that, right? That's the definition. Matter is constructed from particles, and the particles themselves are composed of eight factors: earth, water, fire, wind, visible form, odor, taste, and tangibility, arisen from the elements. Now, that explanation even goes further, doesn't it? If you look in the footnotes in our text, there are things that are made of nine elements, things that are made of 10 and 11 elements. So this is the simplified version, and as far as I'm going tonight. Among forms, there is a difference in the predominance of the elements. For example, even a stone has these eight particles, so we've talked about that. Some may exist in a rather dormant state, such as the wind element in stone, the earth, fire, and wind element are rather dormant in water, yet are present, etc. Since all the elements exist in all forms, trained yogis are said to be able to utilize the potencies of form in any way they wish. For example, walking on water. How does that happen? Using a wall as an open passageway, drawing water from a rock, using air as a platform, and so on. They are able to transform matter from one state to another by drawing on the potencies, due to their levels of concentration, drawing on the potencies that are present but dormant in phenomena. Like that story of Chandrakirti, they say that he milked a picture of a cow and got milk for the whole monastery, wasn't it? Okay, so if you'd like to do some further reading, and then they threw him out. If you would like to do further reading on this particle system of the Sutra School Following Reasoning, then you can look in Debate in Tibetan Buddhism, pages 210 to 217. That's where I took a lot of information tonight. And also Meditation on Emptiness, pages 223 to 232. We haven't gone into it in much detail in the past. I remember Venerable Chodron saying when we were studying Aryadeva, you know, why spend a whole lot of time learning this system when it sort of is debunked by our modern science? At the same time, this is it's like a pedagogical tool. And my point is that in 100, 200 years, we might throw out everything we know about modern science today. So, you know, we just pick a particular period of time, what's known then, and then you hold that like static in time and you start debating it. So that you can learn this system of debate and sharpen the mind. Really, the point of a lot of this is to develop our wisdom, but also to sharpen our mind. So thank you for your participation. And really, the only way we can get to this stuff is by debating. So somehow we're going to have to carve out some time for debating. I keep saying, when you're washing dishes, start debating. Venerable Neema and I have done some great debates at the kitchen sink. Or going for a walk or whatever. All right. So let's dedicate our merit. First of all, let's rejoice that we even have this opportunity to have these crazy conversations and that it sharpens our mind. And we can dedicate our merit for the successful return of Venerable Chodron, the successful teachings and interactions with others, and also her safe return and her good health and long life. And also that of His Holiness, and we can dedicate this for the benefit of all sentient beings.